I'm Yaakov Katz, and welcome to a new episode of the Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis of the State of Affairs in Israel and the Jewish World. On today's episode, we look at the stories of the Jewish people. What is the right narrative right now for Israel and the Jewish world in the aftermath of the October 7th attacks? There is still daily fighting in Gaza and clashes along the border with Lebanon, but it seems that Israelis are entering a new phase, starting to think about the day after and what it means for society and politics. To help us analyze this, I spoke with David Hazzoni, a well-known editor and writer whose newest book, Jewish Priorities, 65 Proposals for the Future of Our People, brings together a remarkable array of new essays from across the Jewish world. It came out on October 24th, 2 weeks after the outbreak of the war. I then catch up with two of my JPPI colleagues, Gil Troy and Shmuel Rosner, to look at this narrative question, and of course, to talk a bit of politics. Here we go. David, it's great to have you on the JPPI podcast. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, Yaakov.
So, you know, a lot of interesting things to talk about. You're a longtime writer, editor, thinker, but we're talking today because of your new book, Jewish Priorities, 65 Proposals for the Future of Our People, which you edited. And let me just say at the top, it has, and looking through the book, articles by really leading luminaries of the Jewish people, Natan Sharansky, Ruth Wise, David Wolpe, Fania Aus Salzberger, Dara Horn, many, many more, and topics that really range across the spectrum. But what I found really interesting, and I, you know, maybe we'll start with this, is this came out October 24th, which is just about 2 weeks after the October 7th attacks. And we're talking now just over 100 days after those attacks and the war that has ensued. So I can only imagine that obviously you did not predict that there would be a war that would happen. And the book was already on its way to being printed, if not printed already by October 24th. So there wasn't the ability to make changes, but I'm guessing that probably now looking at that book, and I was looking at some of the articles just yesterday in preparation for this interview, there's a lot that you can kind of now look at in the new context of the October 7th attack. So kind of walk us through the importance of this book, what it's coming to do, and how to look at it now in this new lens that we have.
So let me just begin by saying that it is every author's nightmare that just as your book is supposed to come out that you've been working on for a year or 2 years or 10 years, some major, humongous, traumatic global event happens that makes the book no longer current. And that was, you know, alongside all of the trauma, one of the things you deal with to help you deal with trauma is to focus on the practical, just putting one foot in front of the other. And everybody in Israel and everybody, it turns out, across the Jewish world were deeply traumatized. And one of my ways of just dealing with it was trying to think, okay, well, we have this massive book launch scheduled 2 weeks from now. What's going to happen with that? And my assumption was that all the events, the 10 or 15 events we had planned in the U.S., would all be canceled. But in fact, something different happened. All of the events, including a full day in Philadelphia on October 22nd and major panels in New York and in Palo Alto, they all took place because all the venues wanted them. They said, we need this now. A gathering of Jews to talk about our collective future is actually really, really important right now. So I did a very difficult thing, which was to get on a plane. It was one of the hardest things I'd ever done, and leave Israel and go to the U.S. And I'll circle back to what that experience was like, but I want to answer your question first, which is, what is this book? The project started about 2.5 years ago, actually, when Adam Bello, the publisher of Wicked Sun, approached me and he said, you know all these writers, you've been working in magazines for years, writers across the Jewish and Israel and Middle East spaces. Maybe you would think about an anthology. And anthologies can be really, really important. They can make a huge contribution. They can be something everybody wants on their bookshelf. You just have to pick the right niche. So what's your niche, he said. And I just blurted out, how about the entire Jewish people? And he laughed and I laughed. And then we thought about it. And what we realized was that there really isn't a single table around which the whole Jewish people sits. For years, we have been focusing either on smaller, more local units like your own denomination, your own community, your own political wing, or having conversations that are about the world as a whole that go outside the Jewish people. But to have a single kind of dinner table around which ultra-Orthodox to secular and left to right politically and younger and older Jewish writers actually sit around that same table and disagree with each other in each other's presence, that thing didn't really exist. So we began work on compiling a collection of essays where each essay would be kind of a priority for our people as a whole. Sort of what we told the writers was, imagine you're giving a TED talk to the whole Jewish people. And my job as editor was to make sure that we didn't have six different pieces on why the Hebrew language was important and to make sure that the pieces were actually interesting. And what we produced in the end was 65 writers, really from all across the Jewish world, geographically, religiously, politically, and coming together not on the things we agree on because we felt that would be dull, but rather on the things that we disagree on, each one promoting their own vision of what we really need.
What were the, I mean, can you give us like some examples of your favorite essays, or is that, am I not allowed to ask a question like that?
Sure. Well, you know, as every parent says, I love all my children equally. But the truth is that there are really some fabulously interesting pieces, ranging from a piece by Eli Pale, who is the publisher of Mishpacha magazine, the foremost ultra-Orthodox publication in the world, called Tzedakonomics, the thesis of which is you can't really understand the Haredi world without first understanding their underlying economic model. And he goes into statistics of voluntarism and charitable giving within that world. Really, really great piece. Another piece by Einat Wilf called Zionism as Therapy, about her experience teaching undergraduates at Georgetown University, and how one of them came up to her and said, and the course was on early Zionist thought, and one of them came up to her and said, this course is like many hours of therapy. So she explored, what does that mean? It turns out that she kind of gives a new lens through which to understand Zionism as a diagnostic process about life in the diaspora and a therapeutic solution or proposal, which doesn't begin with, let's have a Jewish state. It begins with empowering Jews, what today we call Jewish pride. We have Jody Rudoran, the editor of The Forward, on the importance of teaching our children to ask great questions. We have Neri Zilber, the journalist, talking about why Tel Aviv is the true capital of the Jewish people. Really, really fascinating things.
But David, let me push a little on this, because one of the things that I think the Jewish people struggle with recently and in recent years, and I hear this a lot from, you know, philanthropic foundations or Jewish organizations or even in government here, we need a new story. What's our story, right? If we had, you know, the Holocaust and the aftermath of the greatest tragedy and genocide, which of course, you know, now is something to chuckle about, not to chuckle, but look how we're being accused of genocide, the absurdity of everything at The Hague, but the greatest genocide against a people and the Jewish people, and then the establishment of Israel being the safe haven for the Jewish people. And now, as we're strong, and even with October 7th, we still are, I think, objectively a strong nation. What is our story? Is this book also an attempt to give us something to rally behind or around as a nation?
Well, it wasn't at first. I think it may have changed as in the wake of October 7th. At first, the idea was simply to demonstrate that we really are a single people, that there is a single table that we sit around even when we disagree, and maybe to bring into relief what are some of the core components and the things that we do collectively agree on. The centrality of Israel, whether you like it or not, and what Israel means to you may vary. but definitely what the fundamental shift in Jewish history that Yossi Shane spells out in his book, The Israeli Century, that what it means to be a Jew has changed in the last half century because of Israel.
Right.
The question of what our story really is something that has to emerge from a lot of work, that this, I think, is the first step in that work, because we have always conceived ourselves as having a story. Okay, for thousands of years, there has been a Jewish story that tended to be more or less agreed upon, from the revelation at Sinai and the Exodus to the biblical stories to the exile over thousands of years. And it seems that a story is emerging as it's taking place, but we definitely need people who know how to tell that. And so, for example, Ruby Namdar's essay, the novelist, he wrote a beautiful essay called An Agadic Jew, about the centrality of storytelling in the defining of Jewish identity and why it's so incredibly important to have new stories be told. Or the piece by Joe Schwartz on, I think it was called Needed a Jewish Tolkien, but what he was really getting at was the importance of creating new mythology from Jewish sources that could be, you know, building whole worlds like that.
So this book, which came out in English, and I recommend that people pick up and read, because there really are some fascinating essays in there, and it gives you the full flavor and taste of what the Jewish people have to offer, really, with a very diverse group of writers. And it's kind of similar also to what JPPI came out with when we had, ahead of the 75th anniversary and the Independence Day for Israel, also 75 essays that kind of look at also the different issues that Israel is facing. But I'm curious, as we wrap up, David, you know, because it's in English and it's meant for that audience outside of Israel, and we're talking now also after October 7th, the role of diaspora Jewry in what's happening here in Israel. What takeaways do you have from the rollout of the book, the way it's been received, the conversations that are being had, and looking at that connection between diaspora and Israel?
Look, I think the connection is shifting and needs to shift. And I think that October 7th has brought that into very strong relief. When I got to America in late October, I discovered a Jewish community that was traumatized, terrorized, in fear, but also mobilized specifically for Israel. And my feeling was, and I wrote this in a long essay in Sapir, that we're entering a new phase of Jewish history in which the war that Israel is dealing with, that's something that's going to happen, and it's going to play out the way it plays out. But there's also a parallel war happening around the world against the Jewish people, and that the Jewish people as a whole needs to mobilize for itself, and that Israel, and this is something that's been building up for a long time, but I think is extremely important now, Israel needs to take a more of a leadership role when it comes to funding and when it comes to helping Jewish communities around the world, in both the immediate fighting of this war, but also in the longer term, investing in Hebrew language, in education, in Jewish pride, in all of the different areas that need to be rethought and recalibrated now. And I think it will happen, but it's a slow process that still needs to take place, in which the state of Israel needs to step up and take under itself more responsibility for what happens to diaspora Jews around the world.
David Hazzoni, thank you so much for joining us for the podcast. And again, pick up his new book, really a great compilation of essays and thought leaders on state of affairs of Israel and the Jewish people. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
So, Gil, we just heard from David talking a lot about kind of some of those essays and what was coming out of the book and the different visions that people there speak about. But I'm curious, from your perspective, when you think about the aftermath now of October 7th and everything that's happened, you know, Israel used to be this place that provides, I think, like after the Holocaust, provides sanctuary, safe haven for the Jewish people. And I know that a lot of people over the years, and I remember from my time working a bit in government also with the diaspora ministry, there was a lot of talk of, okay, what should the new story be, or the narrative, or the raison d'etre for the Jewish people? Is October 7th a moment in time that needs to re-examine that question?
First of all, I'm relieved because Natan Sharansky and I wrote an essay in that book, and we talked about the need to have an understanding of particularism, not as the opposite of universalism, but actually the best way to do tikkun olam. And I think that essay holds. So you write something and then history happens, and it's a relief to see that it's still relevant. But it's relevant to the conversation, because I think on October 7th, American Jews had what I call a peoplehood moment, as we all did. That moment when you first heard about this vicious anti-Semitism, and it wasn't just anti-Zionism, it wasn't just anti-Israelism, it was anti-Semitic, it was historic, it was epic, it went back to Holocaust and pogroms and millennia of hatred, and it fueled much of the sadism that day. But on our side, as American Jews, as Israeli Jews, as Jews throughout the world, we understood that we are a people. And I think that has to be the start of the conversation. And that particularism isn't this evil force that makes you tribal and makes you look inward, but it's actually a force that's essential to love. Love is preferential. And some of us have been trying to have this conversation about the meaning of Zionism, what I call identity Zionism, for decades. But on October 7th, I think it got renewed. And I know that the New York Times just this week had a big article about the few marginal Jews who decided they're not Zionists. And if you notice in the article, they don't mention numbers, because the numbers are with us. It's actually quite extraordinary, especially after October 7th, more and more American Jews are saying, wait a minute, I'm a part of this. It happened in June 67 as well. And then on top of it, when you add not just the anti-Semitism in America, but the betrayal of the universities. My college roommate, when he read the recent law case against Harvard, where five Harvard students accused Harvard University of anti-Semitism, and he actually read the entire case, he cried. We, as American Jews, have invested so much in the Ivy Leagues, in progressivism, and they've betrayed us. And so Zionism now is not a failure, but is actually, the failure is the anti-Semites who continue to hate us. Zionism never could solve that problem, but Zionism gives us a framework for building from the hatred to something beautiful, from to dream, to hope. And so I actually think this is a very powerful moment for Zionism to redefine itself and also to help explain. The first feeling was a peoplehood moment of, oh my goodness, I'm under attack. The second moment, when people started acting, writing checks, writing letters, pushing, and of course here in Israel defending ourselves, that's Zionism. That's Zionism in action.
So Shmuel, though, I mean, Gil is talking more, I think, about like outward looking, right? What's happening around Jewish communities outside of Israel. But we know that like the conversation inside Israel is one that's very much focused at the moment, at least, on what should the priorities be for the war? Where should, you know, what should the government do? Should they prioritize hostage release? Should they prioritize the toppling of Hamas, which itself is an objective that I put a lot of question marks around anyhow? And also about the political future. Who's the right politician? Who should we vote for? Who's more popular? But there's not really, I haven't seen much of a discussion on the substance, right, of what does Israel stand for today? And what is Israel supposed to be as a country? Or are we just still very much focused on the survival and the war that's being fought today?
Well, you're asking a good question. And it's true that many Israelis are focused on the, I'd call them tactical questions. You know, how should we conduct the war? Should we fight in the north as well as in the south? All kinds of, should we prioritize the release of the hostages over the other, other goal of the war, which is to uproot Hamas? All these questions are tactical in nature. And most of what we see, especially in the media, is related to these tactical questions. I do think, however, and I see it amongst my friends and colleagues, and if you go and tour in the country or go to demonstration, you see this. People do ask themselves existential questions about the ability of Israel to survive and thrive in such environment. You see the doggedness with which Israelis look at the war and treat the difficulties that lay ahead. But you also see the hesitation and the apprehension and the worries about the future of the country, because we must remember that what happened at the war, or at the outset of the war, is a second layer of worries after a first layer of worries was laid out during the previous year. So Israelis got used to asking themselves about the ability of Israel to thrive as a unified country and a unified society since last November, the November before last. And adding the traumatic events of October 7th and the war since then, these questions did not disappear. And in fact, we are in a kind of stalemate. You know, you described the ongoing war in the South. We got used to the morning news of more casualties. The hostages are still hostages. There are still people wounded. There are still rockets in the South and in the North. Nothing, well, a lot is going on, but nothing much is going on in the sense that it's been a while since we've seen change in the situation.
Even the IDF spokesperson, who became a bit of a celebrity, Daniel Hagari, has stopped his daily press conferences because also he doesn't, there's not that urgency anymore.
Yes, things are moving forward slowly, and this creates a sense of a muddled water. It creates a sense of apprehension. And what we see, and we saw this in a recent JPPI survey just last week, a gradual erosion in the confidence of Israelis that Israel is actually going to win the war. The confidence is still very high, but we see a decline, and this decline is somewhat significant, and it testifies to the fact that until and if and until we see a barrage of good news, there is a daily a trickle of bad news. This is what we get on a daily basis. You know, until the hostages are released, until we find and capture or kill the main leaders of Hamas, until there is an agreement on that will end the war and bring about the end of Hamas, until then, it is a daily, you know, daily trickle of bad news, which erodes our confidence in Israel's ability to win. And that's a problem for us.
It's not only until there's good news, it's that there's bad. It's not that there's just trickle of bad news. It's that there's not good news necessarily.
Well, the good news are the good news of the kind that we can't really, you know, be happy with, you know. So we killed few more Hamas operatives or this commander, that commander. You know, people aren't that familiar with each and every commander of Hamas and Hezbollah that is captured or killed during the war. These are not good enough news to compensate for all the bad news that we must grapple these with on a daily basis.
So, Gil, I mean, you know, you've written some really good books that look at the history of some American presidents, Bill Clinton and others, and American politicians. And one of the things that I think politicians do need to some extent is a story to tell, right? Especially when they're facing a big crisis. And what Israel is in is a big crisis, and it needs a story to tell that can provide maybe that victory that Shmuel was just alluding to that we don't have, and it's even questionable if we'll ever get there. And we're starting to see the erosion in Israeli's belief that victory is even possible. I mean, if Netanyahu were to call you up and say, Professor Troy, what story should I be telling as a victory story to my people so they don't all leave me when there are going to be the elections, right? What would your advice be?
Well, in the case of Prime Minister Netanyahu, I would tell him the most important thing you can do, and I called for this in a column over a month and a half ago, and people yelled at me, but now people have thanked me, said, you've got to give a date that you're leaving. And say, I'm going to leave politics because this is a way of saying that every decision I make is not political, because I'm finishing my political career, because just like Golda Meir and others, when there have been big disasters on your watch, you take responsibility. And then you start telling a story. There is a story to tell. There's a story to tell that on October 7th, Israel failed. The government failed. The government made mistakes. The IDF infrastructure and its conception failed. But Zionism succeeded because person by person, soldier by soldier, hero by hero, story by story, we saved the country that day. And that's an extraordinary story. And every day, as heartbreaking it is to read the eulogies of parents and the letters that these young soldiers write, they're actually telling that story of why they do what they do. And these letters that these 21-year-old these 21-year-olds are writing, these wills that they're where they articulate core ideals about Zionism, about Israel, about love of homeland, about love of country, give me not just goosebumps, but give me incredible inspiration. And they understand who they are. And by the way, let's put two more words into this. Idan Amedi. We've just seen a remarkable example of heroism. An international celebrity, 35 years old, married with two kids, head of, you know, star of Fauda, beautiful singer-songwriter. He could have served the war honorably by going around and singing his inspirational songs. Instead, he went like every other grunt. I think he's actually a commander and is a combat engineer. And last week, in that awful explosion, absorbed lots of shrapnel and, thank God, 2 days ago left the ICU, but is still hospitalized. And if you read his Facebook posts from before and some of the messages he's given from his hospital bed about unity, about not disrespecting one another, about basically undoing all the damage that Shmuel was talking about from January through October, and articulating the need for us to be united, that's the consensus here. And it's unfortunate that we're only hearing it from our singer-songwriters and our 21-year-olds. We're not hearing it from our leaders. And that's what I would tell Bibi Netanyahu.
Shmuel, one of the other big questions that we have is the Gantz Eisenkot question, right? Because they are in this government and they continue to sit in there, and there's a growing pressure on them. We saw it from Yair Lapid with comments that he's made, and he's starting the pressure that the longer they stay in the government, the more it basically makes them accomplices to the disasters of Netanyahu and the failures of Netanyahu. What would you believe is the time that they are going to pull out, if at all? Like, how do you see that playing out?
You know, I can't tell you for sure when will be the time, but I think what they're waiting for now are two things. First, to see through the gradual change in the way Israel fights in Gaza, the move from the second phase to the third phase, so to speak, in which Israel conducts operations in Gaza, but not on the same scale. And also, I think they're waiting to see what's going to develop in the north. The northern border is the big question mark that we have now. Just yesterday, two people were killed on the northern border, two Israelis. And the situation between Israel and Hezbollah is very delicate. The chances for eruption are there. It's clear that the international community is trying to pressure. Well, it pressures, I must say, mainly Israel not to move towards a more aggressive mode of operation. While it doesn't offer Israel much in the sense of an arrangement that will enable Israel to convince its citizens to go back to their homes on the northern border. So Israel is facing a very difficult dilemma in the north. And I think both Gantz and his friends from the Machane Mamlachti party are waiting to see what's going to happen there before they make a decision on when and how to leave the government. However, you know, I'll join Gil in speaking about your previous question on the story that Israel markets, and going back to as far as Marshall McLuhan, sometimes it's not the story, it's the medium. And I think that one of the problems that Israel has is that Prime Minister Netanyahu lost his ability to tell any story that will be convincing for many Israelis and for many in the international community. Even if he has the best story to tell, he no longer has the ability to get the ear or the eyes of enough listeners. And I think, you know, that might be a tragedy, and it might be unfair to him or to Israel, but we should recognize the fact that for Israel to tell its story in the best possible way, we need a new medium. We need new storytellers who can market our convincing and uplifting story to the rest of the world. And again, this, I'm not saying this as a political operative. It's not because I'm for or against Prime Minister Netanyahu. It's because I acknowledge the facts. And the facts are that Netanyahu is no longer as effective storyteller as he used to be in the past. And we should work around this problem in some fashion.
I can testify firsthand that it is hard for me to watch and listen to him when he gives those addresses on Saturday night.
We see it in all polls. His approval rating started low at the outset of the war and remained low ever since. And we see a clear correlation between the ability of Israelis to trust Prime Minister Netanyahu and to have confidence in the ability of Israel to win the war. The more they mistrust Netanyahu, and many of them mistrust him, the less they have confidence in Israel's ability to win the war. That's a fact. It's not a political statement. It's a factual statement. And again, it's something that we need to take into account as we think about the best strategy for Israel to tell its story, to explain its story both within Israel and to the international community.
But we should add that Israelis shouldn't feel too badly that they're the only ones who are disappointed in their leaders. We're about to have the official start of the American presidential campaign with the Iowa caucuses in very, very snowy, frozen Iowa. And the polls are showing that both Democrats and Republicans, who disagree on so many things, agree on one thing. They don't want a Joe Biden, Donald Trump rematch, and they are terrified that that's what they're going to get. And so we see that there are two things. One is social media and all the tech structural challenges have brought out a lot of poison into democracies. And secondly, many countries are saddled with leaders whom they simply don't want. And how you get beyond that is a challenge, right?
Swap. We should swap.
Thank you for joining us today. You can find all our episodes where you get your podcasts. Please share widely and give us a 5-star review. We will see you back here soon.